Well, hello and welcome to the Mobility Podcast. I'm Greg Rogers with Securing America's Future Energy, or Safe Greg. And I am at the SAE Innovations and Mobility Conference in Novi, Michigan. Fantastic group of people here discussing a lot of the most interesting things that are happening in transportation policy across all modes. And we're thrilled to be here, and thanks to SAE for hosting us. And today I have Annie Chang. She's the head of new mobility at SAE International, here to chat about micromobility and all the fun stuff happening in that space. So Annie, thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me, Greg.
Yeah, of course. So I guess let's jump right in. What role does SAE play now in sort of the mobility policy and the mobility industry in general?
Yeah, so it's interesting because traditionally we were in the auto and aerospace industries, right? The SAE, A could stand for auto and mm-hmm. aero. But more recently, I would say 3 years, starting 2017, something like this, we started working in shared mobility. Mm-hmm. And last year, we started working in micromobility. So we are not necessarily chasing the trend, but we are helping the industry grow and evolve through facilitating the conversations to set standards, to get to the best practices that will help the different parties involved essentially deploy the technologies in a safer manner, in a more effective manner.
Mm-hmm. And as our listeners might know, SAE has set these standards historically for automotive and aerospace, and probably the most famous example in the AV space is mm-hmm. SAE J3016. And these are fundamental. These industry-based standards are fundamental for making sure that vehicles are safe and for informing regulators. So I think that leads sort of what to the first and perhaps most important question is that whenever we're approaching a new technology, the hardest thing is defining what it actually is mm-hmm. and setting those standards. So how could you talk a little bit about SAE's J3163, which is, it's creating these definitions for shared mobility terms, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So we published that at the end of last year. And it defines terms that are commonly used, yet there are so many definitions. Mm-hmm. For example, what do you call services like UberX or Lyft? Mm-hmm. Some may say ride-hailing, some say ride-sharing, some say ride-sourcing,
TNCs.
Some
say TNCs,
exactly.
Right.
That list is endless. And some even say car-sharing. So we wanted to standardize that, and we worked with key stakeholders. That document was led by Dr. Susan Shaheen from mm-hmm. UC Berkeley, who is a leader in research for the shared mobility field. She's been working in this field for like over 20 years, mm-hmm. Which is very, you don't come by that often, right? Because
right.
everybody is an expert, but then they've only been working in the field for couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
So essentially, we define those, and we also define the different business models. So what is business to consumer? What is business to business when it comes to shared mobility?
Mm-hmm.
What is interesting is that we published that at the end of last year, but we are already revising it. So right now, we are looking at JA3163, a joint aerospace mm-hmm. and ground vehicle standard.
Huh.
So we're going to add UAM, urban air mobility.
Mm-hmm.
So it's going to be a very interesting look at the whole shared mobility landscape in air, on ground, in water.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And did this motivation to also look at air, is this based upon, do you feel that industry is mature enough yet? Or is this more of seeing it, making sure you're setting those sort of ideas and ways about talking earlier on?
Right. I think the idea came from more of mass. So mm-hmm. when we're looking at mobility as a service, a lot of times people forget the air part,
mm-hmm.
But it's really mobility as a whole, this, regardless of what platform it takes, what surface, I guess, it takes form. So we have amazing opportunity because we're SAE and we have such a strong aerospace team. Mm-hmm. I'm working with my counterpart from that team to make this so that it is comprehensive of the entire urban mobility picture.
Mm-hmm. And so going back to the ground, we've seen this massive sort of boom in micromobility, and you know, scooters are flooding the streets and folks think that's good or bad.
Yeah.
But either way, I mean, micromobility has really created this sort of hype and attention towards smaller form factors. Mm-hmm. But what do you think really motivated a lot of this interest in micromobility in the first place?
So I think there are so many factors that contributed to the success or the boom of micromobility. First being the societal trends. The society was already familiar with the concept of shared mobility. Mm-hmm. We're used to it. You have millennials who are not necessarily buying cars, unlike their predecessors, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they are looking for that, you know, some say first, last mile, but it's really maybe the only mile that you're looking for to close that gap and be able to really enjoy travel, which is something that, frankly, a lot of transportation engineers and transportation planners, we haven't thought about. And I am one, right? And
right.
It's we always looked at this utility, lowering that. But what about actually increasing joy and delight
right.
of travel? Is that something that's impossible? I think micromobility has proven that theory to be needs to be revised, maybe, or revisited.
Right, because I remember the first time I rode a scooter, I was grinning from ear to ear.
Yeah.
And then, my God, when I got an e-bike, I was thrilled.
Yeah,
I mean,
absolutely, yeah. And bringing that delight factor, I think, really, contributed to the boom. And then, but then you also wonder, is this then hype? Or can this be sustained in the long run? Can you keep people delighted on their 100th ride of a scooter at the mm-hmm. same level as the delight you have provided in the first two rides?
Mm-hmm. And what do you think the answer to that is?
I think that scooters right now, or micromobility in general, has been more recreationally used.
Mm-hmm.
But we will see vehicle designs that will be more utilitarian focused,
mm-hmm.
Whether it's going to allow you to bring stuff, material load, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right now you can wear a backpack, but that's it.
Right.
I can't travel with my dog, things like this, right?
Or imagining like a little dog basket
exactly.
in the front of the scooter.
Exactly.
I
really would like one. I actually bought a scooter before the scooter pipe, like the powered standing scooter, and I really wanted to travel with my dog,
mm-hmm.
my French bulldog, because I wasn't able to use Uber
mm-hmm.
because the drivers would get mad that
right.
I'm bringing a dog in the car. So I thought that was a really good option,
mm-hmm.
only to realize that I need to find a backpack that fits my dog now,
right?
There's nowhere for her to be seated in the tiny vehicle. So I think that's one.
Mm-hmm.
The second part is the weatherproofing.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, you see, I actually did a study on looking at the impact of weather on e-bikes
mm-hmm.
versus pedal-only bikes versus e-scooters. And when it's good weather, meaning warmer temperatures, no rain, no
mm-hmm.
snow, scooter use is very high. But when it comes to bike sharing, actually there are avid cyclists who use it for their commutes,
mm-hmm.
and they will still use it. So that they're not less sensitive, right,
mm-hmm.
to the weather.
Right, it's like the cyclist model, like there's no such thing as bad weather
exactly,
for cycling, there's
yeah.
bad equipment.
Exactly,
right.
Yes. They just blame the equipment, right?
Right.
That's why you need a $7,000 bike.
Exactly.
So I think we will see more shelled vehicles in the future.
Mm-hmm.
I think the issue is if you get shelled vehicles, the vehicles get fatter.
Right.
Then can you still park them on sidewalks?
And you get into some weird collision protection questions.
Exactly.
That you, in sort of that middle ground between a bike
yes.
where you don't have that, and then the car
yeah.
where you have a lot of them.
Yeah, you're like going from this skinny stick
mm-hmm.
to this fat square, right? And
right.
something in between. Maybe it's a tweezy, right? But tweezers are not legal, from what I know, street legal in most of the places.
A tweezy?
Yes, like Renault tweezy. They're like glorified golf carts.
Oh, really? Okay.
they're very popular in Europe. And it's interesting. You can fit, you know, two people, but they will go one behind another. So it's very narrow.
Gotcha.
Yeah. So you can fit two in one parking spot.
And that kind of addresses one of the biggest problems. Is it's a geometry problem.
Yes.
When we look at all the congestion issues that we face in American cities, I mean, people are driving giant SUVs around for one person.
Yeah.
So that could be. So do you see micromobility as potentially helping to move that interest in different form factors then?
Yes, I do think so. I think that there are so many different issues that need to be addressed, like how do you regulate these things? I'm pretty sure the vehicles that we see right now, in terms of the tiny side, that's not it. We're looking at the tip of the iceberg here. So when the vehicles become weirder, are the regulators ready for it? And you know, the question is, what can we do for SAE, as an SAE, to facilitate that conversation for the industry? We actually are going to publish our first document on micromobility. It's J3194, and that's the taxonomy of micromobility vehicles. So we're officially going to call them powered micromobility vehicles because we are only looking at those that have propulsion assistance or are fully self-propelled. So we're excluding pedal-only bicycles, for example. We have come up with thresholds for what the criteria would be for something to be considered powered micro. And those are, first, it needs to be, the top speed needs to be no greater than 30 miles per hour, which is quite fast. And the weight, the curb weight, so without the human rider and their material load, needs to be no greater than 500 pounds. And these, we actually have strata for each of these variables. So there's like, you know, three or four levels of speeds in between. But we wanted to keep that flexibility to allow innovation so that a new vehicle doesn't come up in the streets like, oh, wait.
We didn't think of that. What do we do now?
Now we have another gap in the taxonomy, right? So we wanted to keep that window open. And we actually identified six types of power micromobility vehicles. And for example, the scooters. I think that was the biggest headache because, like, what on earth is a scooter, right?
Right.
Like, moped, like, scooter was scooter, like, 3 years ago. And now we only think about the kid's scooter plus electric motor, right?
Right.
So we actually divided the scooter type into two. So powered seated scooter and powered standing scooter.
Got it.
Does it have a seat or not? I don't care if it has a seat and you can still stand on it. It's still considered a seated scooter.
Right,
yeah.
Totally.
Yeah, and then we divided the boards by whether it has a self-balancing mechanism or not. And then we have powered skates. You can ask Tony Ho about power skates.
Which we're planning to do tomorrow.
Yeah. Yes, yes. Ninebot has them. And we also have power bicycle, where the e-bikes then would fit in. So we have six types. And definitely, they don't capture the entire micromobility market, but they capture the vast majority at this time. And you can take my word for it. We will have to revise very frequently.
Right. Yes. And you even alluded to some of the things that we're going to have to go back and look at, right? That's fascinating. So on the note of sort of this change in mobility, there's also a shift in how we're thinking about not just the form factors of vehicles, but the data that we need to have on how those vehicles are moving. And could you tell me a little bit about the, it's the Mobility Data Collaborative, right? And this is a consortium that's meant to develop a framework for sharing data, right? So what's, how are you approaching this, and sort of what sort of data are you looking for in doing this?
So right now, it is very common for cities to require data as part of the permit application process, right? So from the micromobility operators. So we're talking about, you know, Jump, Lime, Bird, those guys. And there are data platforms or aggregators like Populous, Remix, Ride Report that kind of sit in between. So data is being shared in order to technically inform city planning. So I have resources, where should I put plan the next bike lane? Mm-hmm. I can use the trip data that I'm getting from the micromobility users, right? Mm-hmm. So you can see the gaps, right? Unfortunately, trip data, especially trip level data, is has a lot of sensitive information, whether it's PII, personally identifiable information, or there are security risks, right, attached to that. So the Mobility Data Collaborative is trying to come up with best practices to reap the benefits of data, but without compromising the security of or the privacy of the users and, you know, protecting the competitive intelligence attached to that as well, and really streamlining the data sharing process.
Such an easy task.
It is exactly so easy. you know, it has been very interesting because we've been talking about this since the beginning of this year, and I've had the absolute pleasure of working with some of the you know, the largest operators and you know, the trend-setting data platforms and cities, and the mission is clear here. We want to use the data, but we need to put the safeguards in place, right? That's it.
And so you're seeing there's the private sector agrees and is interested.
Oh, yeah.
Because they want to see the bike lanes, they want, or micromobility lanes, whatever they call them.
Yes, absolutely. And you know, if I put on my road safety hat here, you as a micromobility user, if you see more bike lanes, you'll feel safer and you'll want to ride more scooters, right? So it makes sense.
And it builds a bigger tent for supporting these bike lanes too.
Yes, yes. So absolutely, the data, there's no doubt about the value of the data. It's a matter of, you know, should we share it at an aggregated level? If so, then what level is that? How can we ensure that you know, it cannot be the users cannot be re-identified using this data? So it's essentially a multi-sector forum where the operators, the data platforms, the cities, and whoever else is engaged in this conversation can come to one place and you know, determine and develop the best practices that's going to support data sharing. So currently we're actually working on two projects. First one is around performance metrics. It is really crazy how many definitions you can get for a vehicle cap. You know, say for example a city has 500 vehicles per operator allowed. Which ones are you counting? Are you counting the ones that are in my garage, like currently dead, or are you counting the ones that are available, all juiced up, ready to go, right? So it's a very interesting conversation, and we're really getting to the nitty-gritty of that. And then the other side, we're working on the contractual language for data sharing agreements. So we're developing a couple of data governance models and then actually writing the legal language that can support those data governance models. So essentially a city and an operator, they could pick and choose which one they would like to use. And you can you don't have to renegotiate, get all your lawyers involved. Very expensive and resource intensive process. You can forego that with this best practice, hopefully.
And I, that's one thing that SAE has always done well historically, is helping to augment the policy making at local, state, federal levels, using that expertise that would be harder for cities to access, I imagine. So that's fantastic to hear. So we've talked a little bit about how folks feel about this, et cetera, but how do you think citizens currently feel about their data being collected as they're moving around?
Yeah, I think it really depends on which city you live in. And some citizens are more aware of there are privacy risks and then others, especially I think the current events regarding, or the at least last couple of years, regarding those risks or their personal information being exposed, has kind of put a bug in their ears. But it really depends on the person. And also, are you going to take action in order to protect your privacy, right? I think, yeah, you will find different responses
Mm-hmm. Excellent. I'd like to turn to accessibility. You've done a lot of great work in this area, but would like to hear about some of what you've done and where you hope to see sort of accessibility go next, sort of in the mobility space, and where attention should be paid.
Yeah, so depends on what do you mean by accessibility. So are you talking about accessibility for people with disabilities?
Yeah, people with disabilities. Let's start there.
Okay, So on that, I did oversee some of SAE's portfolio on making sure that automated vehicles are designed with accessibility in mind. So there is a document, I believe it's J3171, and that is an information report, pretty much a white paper, collecting previous literature on what are the what can we take from, you know, the universal design, you know, approach. Mm-hmm. What can we learn from that? What can we learn from how the web has been designed with accessibility in mind, or smartphones, so that they can be integrated into designing automated vehicles? And it was really interesting because there were so many different types of stakeholders involved, and you also get the advocates, right? Mm-hmm. And it was very challenging, for me at least, to kind of draw that line between what is a standard versus what is needed research or research gaps versus advocacy.
Right.
Because we're not specifying the requirements of a vehicle, but it was a report, right? So there's a really fine line there. And I believe that the On-Road Automated Driving Committee has been able to plow through that and is probably at a point now that the ballot has been done and is ready to be published. But it was a very interesting experience. And I am not an expert in accessibility, but it was an opportunity for me to learn the challenges and the opportunities and kind of also look at that the accessibility issue in the context of other mobility, you know, aspects that I work on. Like, for example, is this electric scooter accessible to everyone?
Right.
I don't think so. Right.
Yeah.
Financially, it's not. You know, someone with a wheelchair, there's no way. But should it be accessible to everyone? Should every single non-private mode of transportation be universally designed? That would be very expensive, right? So it's an interesting conversation. I wish I had more knowledge on it. Love to learn more, and I would love to see SAE do more work in this field.
Absolutely. And you know, I've been at a few forums this year and with talking to people with disabilities who face a variety of sort of mobility impairment and visual impairment and an auditory impairment. What's fascinating is just the range of issues that need to be considered with AVs.
Yeah.
I mean, when you drop someone off with a visual impairment, the suggestion from some folks, some advocates has been, should be able to direct that person on how to get to the door and things like that, and ensuring there are curb cuts. And this is one thing that I think is really exciting about AVs is we're seeing AVs trigger more attention for accessibility, I would hope. Which is really exciting, and I really do hope that continues. And so I suppose where that kind of leads us to is the idea that we should be thinking about these design questions at the beginning, that we should be doing a lot of this research to make sure that this isn't something that's an afterthought like it's been before, right?
Yes, this is, I think, the reason why a lot of advocates have been trying to get involved or ignite this conversation around AVs, because it takes years for vehicle design to actually come to fruition, right, and be on our streets in mass production. And the time is now, they believe. Yes, I think that it needs to be baked in. It's very expensive to try to paste things and fix things after the fact. We have seen that with conventional vehicles. It is extremely expensive to make a conventional vehicle accessible for wheelchairs and whatnot. You're looking at additional, you know, I heard like tens of thousands of dollars on top of the vehicle cost. That shouldn't be the case. However, could we find a way that a vehicle is more modular, that it's more adaptable to whatever the need is? Mm-hmm. Perhaps that is an angle that could drive down costs, yet essentially make the fleet accessible if it needs to be.
Mm-hmm. And so this leads into, I think, the big question. What is good mobility? I mean, how do we improve it?
Yeah. I think from a transportation planning and engineering perspective, it is being able to provide options that mm-hmm. are very, very viable and desirable. Mm-hmm. So a spectrum of options. Say we both live in DC. I'm going from my place near Union Station to work, right? Mm-hmm. I would like to have 5 different travel mode options.
Right.
That are all affordable, that I could pick and choose depending on the weather. The fact that I am able to, say, take a VIA, which is microtransit, to work, and it's super sunny outside, and I don't care if I'm sweaty on the way back home, so mm-hmm. I can take bike share home.
Right.
I think that's beautiful mobility. The fact that, you know, I don't have many options other than to take UberX, mm-hmm. right, to the airport because I have this humongous suitcase.
Right.
That, I think, is limited mobility, mm-hmm. and I hope the options grow so that everyone can be able to afford and have, you know, geographically and financially accessible to good mobility, mm-hmm. which is a spectrum of options.
I totally agree. I mean, mobility is opportunity, but opportunity is best realized when you have choice.
Yes.
I really love the idea of beautiful mobility.
As yes. Being something that, it should be beautiful and joyful, right?
Right. I love it. Annie, thank you for joining me to talk about how we can make mobility beautiful and joyful. Okay. So, Annie, if folks want to learn more about your work, where could they go?
Yeah, we mm-hmm. have sae.org/micromobility, and all of our activities related to this topic is all there, and you can find my email address as well.
Great. And I am at AV Gregar, follow the Mobility Podcast, @ Mobility Podcast, and check out our website, mobilitypodcast.com. Annie, thank you again.
Thank you very much.
This is very enlightening, and looking forward to chatting again soon.
Thank you. Thanks.